WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Fred Cuney, an American relief worker, devoted his life to rebuilding villages and cities that had been destroyed by war or natural disaster. His work often put his own life at risk. That work took him to Somalia, northern Iraq, the Sudan, Nicaragua, and Biafra. In early April, he disappeared in Chechnya, where he was conducting a humanitarian relief assessment. His brother Chris and his son Craig led a search for Cuney. Yesterday, the family called off their search, saying they had information from several sources that Fred Cuney was executed by Chechen rebels in mid-April. The family says a Russian translator and two Russian aid workers traveling with Cuney were executed as well. Cuney's brother and son held a press conference in Moscow yesterday, where they blamed Russian intelligence operatives for spreading disinformation that led Chechens to believe that Cuney was a spy and anti-Islamic. Russian intelligence denies the charges, and the Russian government says it believes Cuney is still alive. But as far as the Cuney family is concerned, Fred Cuney is dead, even though there's no corpse to prove it. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we have an interview with Fred Cuney recorded in November 1993 while he was on a brief visit to the United States. At the time, he was rebuilding gas and water lines in Sarajevo. He and his team were racing to complete the project before the onset of the harsh Bosnian winter. Fred Cuney explained why this project was so important.
Without our project, people have to go down from the hills into the center part of the city in order to fetch water and firewood. And when they do that, they come into the area where the snipers are active from the other side, and many people are killed standing in line or trying to fetch the water and the firewood. In the winter, it's terribly cold. Temperatures are sub-zero from the end of October through the end of April. And especially during the periods when there's snow and ice, it's very difficult to walk several kilometers down into that area, stand in the line of fire, gather the water, take it back to the house, then have to go back out again to get firewood, bring it back in, and go back out again to get food and relief supplies. So our whole effort has been to try and turn the system around, to take energy and to take water to the people to reduce the amount of time that they're spent in the line of fire and the amount of time they have to spend collecting goods and commodities in order to survive.
But, you know, it seems like it would be almost impossible to rebuild part of the infrastructure while Sarajevo is still under siege.
Well, the things that we focused on, water and sanitation and gas, are all linear systems that are underground. Pipes are low enough in the ground that they're not subject to being destroyed by the artillery. And the gas mains are the same way. They're buried in the ground, usually up to half a meter or more below the surface. So they're difficult to destroy. Now, what the Serbs could do is blow up the pumping stations and the pressurization stations and the regulating stations, and they have done that in some areas. So what we did is look at ways of putting the water into the system where we wouldn't require pumps. We would be able to put the water in at the high end of the city up in the hills and then let gravity do the distribution and not rely on energy-driven pumps to pump water up to reservoirs. So we have some pumps in our system, but they're far less than the municipal system used before the war. In the case of the gas, we've been working at ways of protecting the regulators so they can't be destroyed, and burying them in some places or putting them in revetments that would be difficult to destroy, and then working to try and keep the pressure on during the winter.
Now, I believe most of your work has been in developing countries. Sarajevo was a thriving international city. How does that change things for you? Is this a different kind of experience than you've ever had before?
It's very different. The biggest thing is, of course, is the high standard of expectation people have on their living standards and in terms of the food that they eat. In the third world, people often have very restricted diets, usually one grain, some oil, maybe some beans or some other source of protein, occasionally meat. The people of Sarajevo are used to a very rich diet, a varied diet, a full mix of meats and fish and vegetables and so on. And for them to be put back on a relief diet is something that is just utterly shocking to them. That said, I think they've adapted quite well and are taking it in stride and have made adaptations and certainly with the seeds have been able to grow more of the things that they particularly like to eat. For us, though, the biggest problem is that we're working in a winter environment, and the international community has not really been prepared for operations in European or in cold weather environments. We work in the tropics, and all the doctrines, all the programs, the various tools and materials and strategies that we use are all designed for tropical areas where we have tropical diseases, tropical parasites. You have foods that are acclimated to the tropical needs. We don't have to deal with heavy clothing and blankets and so forth. The operations in cold weather are extremely expensive. You're not talking about just providing blankets and sheets. You're talking about providing sleeping bags if there's no energy. Energy becomes a big issue here, not just firewood for fuel, but heating 24 hours a day, and especially different groups of vulnerables. In the third world, the only group that you're really worried about, or the main groups you're worried about, are children under five and pregnant and lactating women. That's where the majority of deaths occur. In cold weather operations, you get not only those groups, but also elderly are at risk because they often are not able to go out and get the energy they need for fire, you know, to heat their houses and for cooking. Clothing is much more expensive. Clothing is rarely a major issue in the third world, yet winter clothing becomes an issue in these cold weather operations. And the costs are astronomical. Normally, we can get by with a couple dollars a day per refugee or per disaster victim in the third world. It's running us well over, $10 and sometimes $20 a day to supply people in the cold weather environments. So these operations are extremely expensive and very difficult to deal with.
We're featuring a 1993 interview with American relief expert Fred Cuny, who disappeared in Chechnya last April. Yesterday, his family said they have information confirming he was executed. We'll hear more from our interview in a moment. This is Fresh Air. Back to our 1993 interview with Fred Cuny. Your company, Intertect, is not a charitable organization. It's a for-profit company. I'm not sure how much a profit you actually make with the work that you do. But you've in fact criticized some charitable organizations for being, and I quote, the last great reserve of the professional amateur. That's a comment you made a few years ago. Do you still stand by that?
Well, I think this is a problem in humanitarianism all across the board, is that there are very few professional organizations. I didn't say that that everyone is unprofessional. But we have, in the case of Bosnia, for example, we've seen some major mistakes in terms of the approach to this war, attempts to try and apply African operational doctrines and programs to a European setting.
For example?
Probably the best example are the attempts to use the supplemental feeding programs in the country. Supplementary feeding is a strategy that's used to rehabilitate people who are coming out of a famine, to bring them back up to a standard of nutrition to where they can go into normal feeding programs. There's no need for this in Bosnia. We shouldn't be putting money into it. What we need to do is to improve the general ration. If we have people who are losing weight and beginning to deteriorate, very few children have been affected by starvation in Bosnia. Adults have been giving their food to the children, whereas in Africa it's usually the opposite. The survival strategies of the developing countries mean that you abandon the weakest children, whereas in Europe the strategy is that you protect your children. They're your cultural heritage and so forth. So we're applying a very expensive and resource-intensive effort to a problem that doesn't exist.
Do you feel like you're learning what kind of food programs, what kind of aid programs would be most efficient in a European city like Sarajevo?
Well, there are a lot of lessons that we're learning. Food is probably not the biggest one. That didn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that you need fattier foods in colder weather. We knew that. But we're learning a lot about the cities under siege and how they operate and what's needed in those situations. For example, as we approach the winter, there's been a big debate within the relief organizations about how to make the houses warmer. What is the strategy we should be using? The UN last year slapped together a strategy that basically provided an opaque plastic sheet which could be taped over the windows, and that's designed to break the wind and to keep the cold out. But it has no thermal value, no insulating value. And we've argued that there are much better materials that are available on the market, foils and a combination of bubble plastic and foil, that will provide a tremendous amount of insulating value that could be more effective and could be used to insulate the houses in such a way that you'd get a reflective component of energy production that would be contributed back in and raise the temperature level, or could make the use of fuels much more efficient. And we've been lobbying very hard within the relief groups to try and get them to use those strategies. We've learned a lot about how to seal rooms up and to make them warmer, what types of stoves are more efficient than others or less efficient, as the case may be. And all of these are going into the store of knowledge. But getting back to your earlier comment about the unprofessionalism of this, some of these lessons we learned in northern Iraq over 2 years ago. And one of the things that's been very surprising is to see many of the agencies who were active in northern Iraq, where those lessons were painfully learned over that two-year period, coming and deploying staff in Bosnia who were new, who were starting at the same point that we started in northern Iraq. And all the lessons from northern Iraq did not transfer to Bosnia. The lessons from Armenia, the earthquake there in 1988, the relief operations in Russia last year, none of those lessons seem to have gotten into the system, and we started once again at square one. And when I criticize the international relief community, it's for not making those lessons available, for not getting the information back into to the headquarters groups and into the training programs, and in many cases for not training staff before they go out to these areas.
Have you had any close calls while rebuilding the water or gas system that you could tell us about?
Have I had any? Every day. certainly our vehicles come under fire quite often. Snipers have taken shots at us. We've been very lucky. All our staff, international and as well as our local staff, have not had serious injuries or wounds as a result of this. But we've had a lot of close calls, and some sooner or later it's probably going to catch up to some of us.
You're not afraid to go out every day and work? Or you just do it in spite of the fact that you're afraid?
Well, you'd be a fool not to be afraid. We certainly watch the news reports and find out where, listen to the radio and find out where the firing is during the day. We know, the areas where sniping occurs, and you certainly know the main areas along the lines of contact where there's a lot of firing, and you avoid those as much as you can. There are routes that go through the city. There's one road we all call the Trail of Tears, where the city has put containers and metal panels and stuff up so that people who are walking from one end of the city to the other have some cover, and our vehicles try and move very rapidly through those areas. But there is no place in the city that's 100% safe, and every day you do run risks. But this is where the people have needs, and you have to go to where the people are in order to provide the assistance. We can't. I don't feel we can back off just because of a risk. These people take the risks every day. We should have to take them as well if we're going to provide humanitarian assistance.
Fred Cuney recorded in 1993. According to his Dallas-based company, Intertect, Cuney's water restoration project in Sarajevo is now providing about 90% of Sarajevo's available clean water. Cuney disappeared in Chechnya last April. Yesterday, his family gave up their search, saying they believe he was executed. This is Fresh Air.